Henry, what is public education today? How do you define it? What does it mean?
Well, that's a good question because it's changing and it seems to be changing quickly. So it's clearly much broader in definition and now would include really anything that receives public dollars. So you could argue that in a sense vouchers are public funding, public education, because it now pays for, in some cities and states, a vast majority of the cost of educating children. Clearly, charter schools are defined as publicly funded, even though they often operate outside of the context of traditional public school governance. And then even homeschooling and online schooling, there's government funding available for those things as well. So a much broader definition than we had in the past.
So, but what do we want to achieve? You know, so given that, let's say, expanding array of education, what should society achieve? What's your view on that?
Well, I mean, I think the goal in the United States, and then more locally, city by city, is to have an educational system that propels the economy locally and enables the United States to compete effectively worldwide. And where, you know, people disagree on how well we're doing in that, but the general sense is that increasingly our educational system is falling behind. You know, it's to be the best, because if you have the best educational system, then you will be able to provide the best workers, and then your economy will obviously be more successful. So that I guess is the goal.
Okay. So let's talk a minute about your education, Henry. So how were you educated, and how did you get from a young child to your position today?
Well, I was blessed with a phenomenal education, which is why I'm so passionate, because there's no doubt in my mind that the specific schools I went to and the high quality of the education that I got enabled me to do what matches my gifts and talents and what I'm passionate about. And my feeling is simple. Every single child in the United States ought to have that opportunity, regardless of their race, their socioeconomic level. Everybody should have it, even their family. Whatever your family is like, you should still have an access to a great school. So I started my formal education really in the United States, moving here when I was 4, got a phenomenal foundation in the New York City public school system. And then at age 7 was sent to a boarding school in England, and I did 10 years in British boarding schools, which both of them were very good, very academic, very challenging, so that by the time I was ready to go to college, I had decided I wanted to go to college in the United States and had set my heart on Northwestern University, and was able to get admitted. Spent 4 years there, and then decided to do work in the Central City. And so I worked for Habitat for Humanity through the AmeriCorps National Service Program. After doing that, I was hired by Habitat to do 2 more years. And it was during that time that I was really confronted with the reality that in Chicago, while housing was an important issue, unless we were educating kids effectively, we would be just repeating the same old cycle of kids not being able to get decent jobs and then needing specialized housing, living off welfare or whatever else. And so I started to read about school reform in Chicago, which at the time was very vibrant. Decided to go back to school, got my master's of secondary education at DePaul University, and then entered the Chicago public schools. I student taught in CPS and taught for 1 year at a middle school in Uptown, Chicago, and then went to the suburbs, taught 2 years in a public high school in Niles, Illinois, and then moved to Milwaukee and joined St. Marcus, and I've now been serving here for a decade.
Wow. it's a fairly elaborate path for an educator, really, I mean, today.
Yeah, it's not where I thought I would end up, but, you know, it's interesting to me in hindsight. Every step of the way really helped me be prepared for what I do today.
Yeah, fascinating. So what is success? So given where you are today, how do you define success with your students and staff? What is that?
Good question. Complicated is what it is. Success for students is that in 8 years after they graduate 8th grade, that they are productive, fulfilled, members of society. That's a big part of it. We are a Christian school. We prioritize heavily our religious instruction. So first and foremost for me, it's that children understand who they are in Christ, and that they know that they were created by God with gifts and talents and for a purpose. And to me, you know, even at the K-8 level, obviously that's transformative information. And when kids understand that, they start to live very effective, fulfilled lives, despite some major obstacles in their lives. And so for me, the number one success is measured by, you know, 8 years later, are they still living that way as somebody who's created with a purpose, with gifts and talents, you know, has some purpose in life? And then secondly, are they able to use their gifts and talents in a productive way? And in general, we would expect a high percentage of our students to attend and graduate from a four-year university. But we do have students who are better suited to a two-year technical degree. And then some who choose to go right into the workforce, although that's now a very small percentage. But even then, our city has some jobs that you can get out of high school that are effective, meaningful work that generally, though, would be accompanied by further training. But 8 years on, are they living their lives in a fulfilled and effective kind of way? That's success. Now, clearly, you need benchmarks every step of the way as you move through that. And so before they graduate eighth grade, we would expect that every graduate is in the top 30% of students in the state and in their core subject areas as measured by the state standardized test, which is the WKCE.
Right.
And that the eighth graders, as they go into ninth grade, all get placed specifically and individually into high schools that would be the best possible fit for them. And then backing it up even further on a year-to-year basis, are kids overcoming the behavioral or social behaviors that are negative? Are those being addressed, and are they growing? Are they growing in their faith in what it means to be a practicing Christian? And are they moving forward academically at a pace that, no matter what their starting point, and many of our students come in very far behind, are they moving forward quickly enough to be in the top 30% by the time they graduate eighth grade? That's how we would measure success. For students, for staff, you know, very oddly, very similar. Are they in a context where they're in the right seat on the bus so that they can use their God-given gifts and talents to be of greatest service to the kingdom of God? And that means effectively helping kids understand who they are in Christ and effectively training them to use their gifts and talents effectively.
And obviously you're tracking this, because I see behind you have the board of your graduates and what they're doing. So describe how you're tracking them a bit after they leave.
Well, we now have an alumni coordinator who's responsible for placing every kid in the right high school, working with the child and, when possible, their parents, and then gathering data from those high schools or colleges for the next 8 years. And so we're tracking now the last eight graduating classes. The oldest one was the class of 2005, who are going into their senior year in college. And so we're in touch with every single one of them, with one exception. We can't find Kadeem Edwards. If anybody knows where he is, please call me.
Okay.
So other than that, we get the information from the high schools, and then with the colleges, we literally go student by student, family by family, using social media to make sure we know where everybody is. And we've been able to keep track of almost everybody.
Fascinating.
That's how we do it.
So when you hire teachers, what do you look for? What have you learned to be effective over this past decade?
I've learned that it's most effective to train teachers in-house. Our model is unusual. We have very specific pedagogical methods and beliefs. And so training them in-house, if you want a smooth transition for a new teacher, they need to have either student taught at St. Marcus or served as an educational assistant under an expert teacher. And then increasingly, we're able to place students into year-long internships where they would actually be on-site for the whole year, student teaching and working during the mornings on-site and then taking classes in the afternoons. And so those methods are by far the most effective. Beyond that, if we can't find enough teachers who are in that pipeline, we go to fairly specific training colleges. Martin Luther College in New Ulm, Minnesota is the traditional training route for St. Marcus teachers. Now, if they're from Martin Luther College, we would definitely prefer that they are partnered with a place like the Center for Urban Teaching at Wisconsin Lutheran College, which is our second main feeder, is the Center for Urban Teaching at Wisconsin Lutheran College. And these are students who have been trained very specifically in a no excuses approach to education, which is the one that we adhere to. And so that's where we look. If we're unable to find enough teachers from those pipelines, then we look a little bit further afield for particular personality types. People who are very high energy, have strong personalities, and bring with them a natural refusal to make excuses for themselves personally or to make excuses for the children that they'll be working with. And so the fundamental philosophy that you have to have walking in the door is a non-negotiable belief that every single child can and must be successful. And so when I'm interviewing candidates, we look right away for excuse making or a sense of excessive sympathy for kids who are growing up in tough circumstances, where that sympathy so easily converts to not expecting a whole lot out of them.
Right, the tyranny of low expectations, right?
Correct, correct.
And then what about parents? You know, when we met the first time, you said you have no expectations from parents, more or less. So maybe you can describe that a bit.
Yeah, I would have to retract that statement, or just rephrase it, both because it will get me into trouble and because it's not quite accurate. Clearly, when we have engaged parents, we're more successful. That's sort of a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. Reality is 90% of our students are low-income students, predominantly African-American. And the reality is that many their family structures are dealing with all of the issues that surround people growing up in poverty. And so, you know, even when you have a single mother with three kids who may be radically committed to their children's education, she's probably working a full-time job. In some instances, a job and a half.
Right.
And then there's three kids. And she's doing that on a low income, so she may be taking the bus to work. Everywhere she goes, she's got to take a bus. Like, how do you ask a parent like that to be intricately engaged in their child's education? So we have a slightly unusual approach, which is we have a doors open policy. Parents are always welcome. They can always be in the building. But when it comes to actually delivering the product, we don't rely heavily on parents. So the rule of thumb that we now use is we actually have relatively low expectations for active parent participation, but we do enforce those parents 100%. So for example, you have to attend parent-teacher conferences. And if a parent doesn't show up, they got a week to do it, and if they don't do it in a week, then there are painful consequences, either for the parent or the child or both, depending on the age. But you have to do the parent-teacher conference. And we'll make all kinds of ways to make it easy on the parent, but you have to come to the building and you have to meet with the teachers. So that's a non-negotiable. Another one would be getting children to school on time and being in school. We will go, we will do anything to help a parent with those issues. Just don't make excuses for why your child can't get to school on time, and don't like keep them home for bogus reasons. And most parents don't, but we will go to war, as you might say, with parents who aren't cooperating with those basic fundamentals. We expect parents to make sure their children do the homework. When that doesn't happen, we come up with creative solutions. So the other side of it that's sort of new for us is that more recently we have been able to increase our pastoral support for parents. And so we're finding new and creative ways to reach parents from a pastoral family support perspective. So now we do something called Thankful Thursdays. Every Thursday, one classroom's parents are invited to come in for a really decent breakfast to meet with school administrators and the pastoral staff to learn about the church and the school. And then the students come down from the class and they read a poem or they do a short song performance. And then everybody goes up to the classroom and we do a 30-minute reading instruction class. Wow. Where we're both instructing both the students and the parents,
right,
on some really key reading mechanisms. We've had great response, great turnout. And so we're getting more parents engaged. But there are some families where we sort of have to go it alone, requiring very little, but enforcing it 100%.
Wow. So what about expanding your model? Obviously, we have extremely large education organizations across the country. We have small ones. You know, can you replicate this model you mentioned when we met, sort of this school within a school thing to then expand that way? So is that working? How will that work? Well, tell me about it.
Sure. Well, let me start small and then get bigger. So, just over a decade ago, we had 95 kids.
Right.
And it was a big, audacious goal to build a new building and get to 300 kids. We did that, and it, like, literally instantly, we needed another building with 350 kids. And so we built that building. And it built instantly, just this last September. And so then we had, hundreds of kids on waiting lists. And so, clearly, fundamentally, there's a huge commitment not to compromise quality. But when you have hundreds and hundreds of parents who are walking in, some of them literally sort of in tears of frustration saying, you've got to help me, there is a obligation to figure out, well, so how quickly can we grow this thing? So a year ago, we found ourselves with both buildings completely full and a whole classroom of first and second graders on the waiting list. Well, we made room for them and admitted a third first grade and a third second grade. And so now the board just last week has authorized a 6-month feasibility study to look at the possibility of opening a second campus. And the model that we've created is to seed that campus on our current site, train the administrators, train a core set of teachers, and then pick up those kids and move them onto a new site with the staff intact, and then grow it from a seed school of about 200 kids up to a major school of between 500 and 600 kids. And the biggest struggle, frankly, isn't the money from a capital perspective, it isn't the supply of kids. It's how many teachers can we find that can do this.
Right.
And, this last year, because of the rate of expansion, 15 of our 23 lead classroom teachers were brand new. And
wow.
there were some hiccups along the way, but we had a phenomenally effective year, and our kids continued to perform at a very high level. And so I've now come to believe that the model is replicable, I believe that 600 to 700 kids on one campus K-8 is as big as you should go for all kinds of reasons. And so the goal is ultimately to have this campus at 600 kids by moving a group of them onto a second campus, and then rolling out another campus and beyond that, the third campus. And so it's really a question of how quickly can we find the teachers and how quickly can we find buildings that we could use, acquire, and operate, as quickly as possible. So we're just going to keep going. So on a local level, highly replicable.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd say, and this is why I'm such an optimist about urban education, both in Milwaukee and in America, that we're not an anomaly, that there are schools, public, charter, and private, all over our country, that are with very high levels of kids in poverty, achieving very high levels of success. And so we are not like the first trip to the moon. This would be like we've been to the moon 100 times. Let's go again. Let's keep going to the moon. So I'm a tremendous optimist about what can be done in Milwaukee and nationally.
Great, great. Now, you've had experience both in public and private. So given the challenges you describe in the urban setting and success, can both models succeed for these kids? What's your sense of that, given your experience?
Yeah, I mean, both models absolutely can be successful. And in some cities in the United States, they've been far more successful than others.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're talking about charter, voucher, public, or purely private education, what we have to do is look at the models that work and then expand and replicate them. And this is where, as a city, historically, we failed.
Mm-hmm.
We have been so caught up in a fight between the different sectors,
right, right,
and have so failed to focus on what works, that we haven't, frankly, made a whole lot of progress. Now, I'm thrilled that in the last 18 months, that dynamic has changed dramatically, that as a community, we are focusing on the models that work, As a community, we're trying to expand and replicate them. And finally, we have a very healthy dialogue between the three different sectors, where we're visiting each other's schools, at least on the principal level. I'm in touch with a whole bunch of MPS principals. They're coming here. I've been to their schools. And so there's a much more productive dialogue that's beginning to take place.
That's great.
Clearly, I think that we all understand that a single independent, albeit largely publicly funded, private school like St. Marcus can move much more quickly, can implement and change much more quickly without some of the major restrictions that a public school would have. But with some very dramatic, very big changes that would need some strong political support, I personally believe that MPS has the capacity to become a highly effective educational system for our city.
Interesting. So one of the things voucher schools are criticized for is the apparent lack of special education support. You know, can you discuss that a bit? I mean, how do you address that in your school?
Well, I'd first of all say that in some senses the criticism is valid. It's valid in the sense that, especially with the neediest, the absolute neediest special education students, the ones with the heaviest physical impairments,
right,
that would require, for example, one-to-one help,
right,
MPS operates some phenomenal schools at huge expense that serves those children. Ginsland Elementary is not far from here, and I was awed by the work that they do. Now, they're partly able to do that work because they get a very significant amount of funding to work with those students. Whereas when we have special education students, whatever their needs, there isn't a penny in additional funding for that. And so it's a little hard to make the criticism that voucher schools don't effectively serve special education students when absolutely no money is provided for those services. It just doesn't make sense. The voucher amount that we operate under is $6,400. That's what it costs a Wisconsin taxpayer to send a child to St. Marcus. To send a child to the Milwaukee Public Schools, we debate about the number, but it's somewhere between $12,000 and $14,000,
right,
so at least twice as much. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, I would tell you that we serve a very large number of special education students. Right now, it's between 50 and 60 children have special needs at St. Marcus, almost all of which are defined, designated special needs, some of which, under the current laws, can't even qualify for the designations because of state law. But we get tremendous feedback about the special education services we provide for students. Some of them are very severe, both physical and academic mental special needs. We partner with a wide variety of agencies to provide those services, and we partner with MPS. We have an MPS special education instructor who comes to St. Marcus to service some of our students. Those services are helpful but wildly inadequate, given what we then have to provide the children because of what is not provided by the public sector. And then finally, I'd say within the voucher schools, there are some, like St. Marcus, that provide an incredibly high level of education for a good number of special needs students. And then there are those that really don't do very well at all. And I think that's probably true within MPS also. So it's a broad spectrum of services. But the numbers that you read about in the media and that the Department of Public Instruction likes to put out there, numbers like we serve 1% special needs students, those numbers have clearly been proven to be wholly unreliable and wrong. And I would guess that our number is closer to 11 or 12% system-wide.
You mentioned your per-student voucher income, but you spend additional money that's raised elsewhere through your church. So describe the total spending per student and how you achieve that, Henry.
The voucher amount is $6,400. We spend right now about $7,800 per child. And I would argue that you cannot effectively educate children in the city of Milwaukee with a high percentage that are low income for less than $7,500. And so, you know, the voucher amount has been at $6,400 now for about 5 years.
Right.
It went up a little bit and then it went back down to $6,400. And so people need to understand that voucher schools are trying to serve a population that is by definition lower income on $6,400. And it just is very, very difficult to do. Now, we raise about another $1,500 per child from a whole variety of different sources. But what the community needs to understand is that for $7,400, not only do we provide an incredibly rigorous academic product with very strong results, but we also extend our hours of operation dramatically. So right. for that $7,700 per child, children have access to the building from 6:30 in the morning until 8:30 at night. We also have a Saturday school, 32 weeks a year, that is mandatory for some students. That's from 9 in the morning until 12:30 in the afternoon. We also operate, for that same amount of money, a 5-week summer school program, which started today and has 315 students in it. So you're sort of getting the picture that, for $7,700, you have a school building that's open from 6:30 in the morning till 8:30 at night, a Saturday school and a 5-week summer school program. Well, no wonder that our kids are highly successful.
Right.
We should expect nothing less from all of our schools, because for that amount of money, I believe it's achievable. But I will say this, that if we don't increase the voucher amount very, very soon, it will inhibit our future growth. We cannot continue to raise $1,500 per child at our rate of growth. And we will begin to cut some of these programs that are critical for student success. So I don't know who's reading this, but a critical message I need to get out there to the governor, to the legislature, to the mayor of Milwaukee, is that that number absolutely has to go up, or some of our strongest models in the central city will begin to decline.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to chat today, Henry. That was great. Anything else that I should ask you about or share?
I don't think so. I think we've covered the gamut. I would just say maybe one final pitch is my personal conviction that Milwaukee has done an awful lot right. We have a great state. Wisconsinites are good Midwesterners. We have an incredible philanthropic community that's committed to the central city. We have a business community that's incredibly fired up to resolve these issues. And what we need now is some strong political leadership to make some fairly simple changes and some fundamental changes. My conviction is that by 2025, Milwaukee ought to have the best educational system in the United States of any major city. And one of the ways that we'll get there is when the folks in the suburbs, I mean just general people in the suburbs and throughout the community, figure out how they can help. And it could be financially, or it could be with their expertise. We need small business leaders from Waukesha and from Franklin to give a couple hours a month on a board or on an advisory committee. But if the whole community of Southeast Wisconsin pulls together, we can absolutely change this, and it will do our economy a world of good, and everybody will benefit. So for the general population, the message is get engaged. Come and help us out.
Great. All right. I'm going to stop recording.